On this episode, I was joined by David Rutledge. He's the author of the book Mythical Medical. He's the CEO of Global Strategic Solutions, and he consults with his expertise in clinical and regulatory. He's also served as the industry rep on an FDA advisory committee through CDRH. On this episode, David and I talk about his book Mythical Medical. We highlight a couple chapters. I really enjoyed the chapters on audit, post-market surveillance, benefit. We dig into benefit in particular in quite a bit of detail. He has an interesting take on it as a clinician. We also talk about EU MDR and his role as a PRRC. I hope you enjoy this episode with David. As always, if you like the show, hit pause, please. Give it a 5-star rating, and you can always reach me at letscombinate.com if you have any feedback or suggestions. I hope you enjoy this episode with David.
You're listening to another impactful episode of the Combinate podcast, the show where we drive for quality in everything, because quality is everything. I'm your host, Subi Sade. I've been working on medical devices, pharmaceuticals, and combination products for the last 10 years, and my goal is to understand. Each week, I sit down with leaders to understand and bring together medtech and biotech in order to examine the roadblocks in development and access we face and bring to light concepts and tools from our industry and others to help address those. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Kind of grew up in clinical, having gone up through academia, assistant associate, full professor, tenured chairman, you know, tenured, et cetera. And then I joined a big pharma company and then a big medical device company, and I've been a consultant for the last going on four years. And I'm a lead auditor for 1345. So yeah, you know, I have a BS in PharmD and from the University of Texas, 1 year residency at HUP in Philadelphia, 2-year fellowship at University of Tennessee. I sort of brand myself now as a clinical, regulatory, and quality kind of guy, person responsible for regulatory compliance. And what else would be fun to say something about? Oh, served on the FDA advisory committee as an industry rep, learned an awful lot about inner workings of FDA when I did that. And I'm also on the advisory board to the team PRRC board over in Europe that qualifies people to be PRRCs. I'm naturally curious. That's about it. Yeah.
Well, you missed a big one, your book.
Oh, yeah. I'm now an author. Yeah. Yeah. It was really kind of fun. So, yeah, I wrote a lot of articles when I left industry and wrote a lot of articles on, created this company called Mythical Medical, which is sort of like an ideal company that represents companies, most of the companies in our sector. And then I've created characters, got a LA Hollywood writer to help me to create and develop characters and weave them through, you know, turned all my LinkedIn articles into chapters and books in a book and went like that. Yeah. So it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun doing it.
Okay. So your book, Mythical Medical, takes a kind of green thumb person who is green as well, right? Somebody who has sort of a natural knack for quality and regulatory, but is relatively inexperienced. And you kind of take them on a journey. They attend a conference, they hear a talk, and then from there unwinds kind of the tale of Mythical Medical. Yeah. I'm not going to spoil the story. If you want to read it, the book is basically free on Kindle. It's 99¢ if you get it on Kindle. I think it's you can get it on the iPhone app. I read it on my iPad, even though I do have.
Oh, good. Well, so you must have the Kindle app then.
I do, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's 99¢, or it's free if you have Kindle Unlimited. But I do want to discuss a couple chapters, right? And I think one of the things that's interesting about the work that you've done is the emphasis on the discussion for benefit. And I think in the chapter in the book, it's called The Unsolvable Equation, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right? The Unsolvable Equation. So what is that about?
Well, you know, I put that title in there, you know, because, you know, I wanted to, you know, people say risk benefit ratio, benefit risk ratio, and it makes it sound like it's the mathematical equation. And it's really not. And the root problem of that is the benefits, the denominators usually of the benefits are not matched up to the denominators of the risk, basically. So it's not really an intuitive solving equation kind of thing. So
are you saying that typically companies are more focused on assessing the risk instead of demonstrating the benefit?
Excuse me for interrupting. Were you through with that? So what I was going to say is that, you know, in our medical device sector, we've spent years, maybe 20 years or more in some cases, looking at, you know, early on risk to the patient, even before it hits the market, and then after it hits the market. And we've dealt with that. We've dealt with audits. We've dealt with all kinds of fires that we've had to put out, all hands on deck, for many, many years. And recently, within the last 5 years, let's say, there's been an emphasis on, from regulatory bodies and notified bodies to all over the world, to better talk about the benefits of the products. And so I actually gave this talk many years, 3 to 4 years ago, about benefits and risk, and have written a LinkedIn article about it, and have asked to do some podcasts on benefit risk, because if we had to put this as a university setting, we've got graduate degrees in risk, but in benefits in general, we have sort of like a freshman and sophomore kind of intellect when it comes to benefits. We don't really know what they are sometimes. We don't really know that there could be multiple ones. We don't think about them being short and long-term and things like that. And also the assumptions that we're making for both benefits and risk, you know, that kind of thing. And also remembering that it's all about the patient, right? And of course, the person using the product for the patient or whatever, but you need to look at this through the eyes of the patient or the user of the device, and try to think of those. I know we have sales benefits and claims, and any claim is going to be a benefit, but sometimes, you know, it doesn't mean a lot to patients, you know, as an example. Maybe it means something to the healthcare system or whatever, but we need to really focus on the patient. So that's sort of where that came from, the chapter on the solvable equation. You know, that's having fun with the title to be able to remember the benefit risk is situations, you know. Yeah.
What inputs do you think typically should be considered but are not considered when you talk about the benefit?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I've run these sessions before, and we sort of start out with, I don't know, 10 or 12 kind of types of benefits, but then we sort of want to get them into, let's say, 7 different buckets. And those buckets I start out would be types of benefits. Okay, let's have a discussion in the room. First of all, making sure you've got a lot of people in the room to have the discussion, representing the different functions at the manufacturer. You know, most companies will say, "Oh, that's Phil's workers, or Mary, or Sally, or whatever," and she'll write the benefit, you know, in the section and the risk. But it really needs a team. And so I talk about it in the LinkedIn article and in the chapter. Get the functional groups together and let them have a robust discussion of the types of benefits we could talk about. In-hospital benefits, you know, 30-day benefits, 1-year benefits, in all things considered. And then we need to talk about magnitude of the benefits, right? And understanding it could be short-term, it could be a lifelong benefit, et cetera. But we need to have that discussion about your device and the disease, with the magnitude of the benefit. And then from there, there needs to be this discussion among the team about the likelihood of having more than one benefit, you know, for an example, and how what's the duration of effect. And that kind of gets at this, the magnitude and stuff, but the duration of that benefit. And then finally, two more, I guess, would be benefits to healthcare professionals or caregivers, and have that discussion. Some devices won't have that, but many do. And then comparing that benefit to what I would refer to would be kind of a state of the art benefit. If they didn't get your product, what would they get? So put your benefits in the state of the art of what they could be compared to, you know, as an example. So that's kind of where the discussion, this really takes hours to have these discussions to nail it all down, because you want to go back and try to make sure you have data to support all these benefits, you know what I'm saying? Because that's what the regulators are looking for. Yeah.
So those are kind of the buckets, right? You mentioned benefits to healthcare professionals, the state of the art there at the end, hospital, the length of the benefit in that.
Yes.
But what are the data inputs that you would categorize into those categories?
I mean, I think it could start with a device in terms of ease of use. It could start with the benefits of having several varieties of the device that could be appropriate. It could be, you know, the small, medium, large, or kind of device. It could be pediatric sizes, et cetera. It even could be custom made in some cases, which could be a benefit. And then from there, you want to look at the benefit of addressing the disease. Like, you know, this you're in the combination products, right? I've submitted three MDR combination devices. So all three of them, and I've submitted others, but I think all three of these had steroid on them. So there was a steroid that was released to kind of address inflammation early on, you know, which could decrease the morbidities in hospital. And then later on within the first, sometimes in 30 days, and in another case, 6 months to a year, because it dissolved over the year. So it could be that perspective too, you know, having a benefit affecting the disease, you know, as an example. So, and it could be, maybe a benefit would be, there is some, you know, what do you call it? If you try to use the device and it doesn't work, we'll give you a free one, you know, to replace it, you know, as an example, just from a contracting standpoint, a benefit in pricing or bundling and things like that. But you've got to have data to support that. So that's sort of three broad examples, starting with the device, and it could be sterility, packaging, and all these things from that end. And then once it hits the shelves, you know, easy to find on the shelf, you know, easy to unpack, easy to use once you get it with the patient. And then in some cases, the patients need to take it so directions are easy to follow, and you've got useful training materials, and we're getting really innovative in the types of training materials. So, you know, as you start these discussions from the different perspectives in the company, you get all these benefits that are talked about. And it just amazes, you know, that one person that would have missed all this if it was just up to them, you know, to write the benefits. Hence, we need to have the team, you know, together. Yeah.
So in terms of risk management.
Yeah.
In my experience, you know, I've seen different companies handle the benefit risk analysis in say different ways. One commonality that I've seen in a couple companies is that benefit isn't talked to until the end, and until you have an understanding of say what the marginal / high risks are. You know, to use a traffic light example, say the reds and the yellows, and start to build that benefit risk ratio against those. It sounds like maybe you're recommending that it be done as an independent activity and not just a reaction to those.
Absolutely. And at the very beginning too, right? And even, right when you're developing that risk plan, it really needs to be the benefit risk plan. And I sort of tell people to use the word benefit first when you talk about benefit risk, so that it highlights that area that we need to grow more in, you know. Plus, we got that good job to get in the hazardous situations, harms, and then risk of occurrence and severity of risk. And we've got that down pretty well. We know that, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, modeling that along with the benefits to offset that. And someone said one is what we need to get better at. And someone said one day to me, what do you think the easiest benefit risk analysis would be? And I said, well, the serious risk devices, if they save lives, it's hard to trump that, right? You know, so those are but that's a smaller sector within our medical device business, right? Those serious risk devices, and the hardest ones to do as you start backing up to moderate risk or mild risk, because there's just not a lot of interest in spending money to try to collect the data that you're going to need. You know, that kind of thing. So
what functions typically, I mean, in your experience and I guess per your recommendation, should hold the, I mean, you said a bunch of people getting in the room, right? But they need to have something to discuss. So is it as simple as literature review? And I mean, what are the inputs?
It's all, you know, let's just take the functions, you know, you've got your quality process, and whoever is involved with your CAPA process or recalls, they need to be part of that discussion. What are the root causes of that have happened? How did it come into the organization? And talk about your complaint handling group and let them be involved in some way to give updated figures and trending and things like that. Talk about the marketing group. What are they hearing in the field, you know, as an example. You talk about the, I'll put it in as either the clinical affairs organization, the medical affairs organization, or the CMO part of the organization. You know, what's their experience with the healthcare practitioners and what are they telling them, you know, as an example. You got the regulatory people who are dealing with regulatory bodies and of similar products that like you have there. You've got the clin ops people who are at the hospitals, you know, running some clinical trials as an example and monitoring. And you've got them picking up on the discussions that occur on that end. I'm not looking at my slide at the moment, but I think I probably have about, and so you want to look at, you know, you want to look at your clinical literature, your complaints, your clinical trial data. You want to look at public databases like the MAUDE database, BfArM for recalls over in Germany. If you're in Germany, TGA, if you're down in Australia, you know, what you want to, or, you know, PMDA, if you're in Japan, you know, in China, et cetera. So you want to look at the publicly available data too. And that's becoming and of course, Udemed is going to be publicly available at some point, that'll be a database that we'll need to look at as we start looking at our risk assessments. Yeah. And you need to get statisticians involved to help with stats around trending, you know, as an example, and the assumptions around that. So, you know, you could kind of go through most of the major pieces of the organization and come up with, you know, their view of the data that needs to be collected. So it's more than just, and it's ongoing too. It's more than just the literature review, you know, and it's more than just your product. You want to look at your product and similar products, you know, as an example. So it's a good time for our business because there's a lot of opportunity for growth in the business and professional development. It's an important focus of regulatory bodies all over the world. Yeah.
Do you find that there's kind of harmonized expectations around benefit, or is it different based on region?
I think there's growing harmonization around asking the questions about the benefits of the product. I think I will say this, that the FDA has really led the way by putting out some wonderful guidance documents to talk about benefit and risk. And I've been looking at those, you know, before they became official guidances and stuff like that along the way. And then notified bodies such as over in Europe, and then their counterparts that they have in different countries, like their notified body of personnel in India, in Australia, and, you know, Singapore, and China, in Japan, etc., where they're going to try to bring their products in Canada to Europe, you know, as an example. You know, those, you know, are important reasons why there's getting to be more harmonization in benefits, you know, as an example, along the way, because we've got regulatory people that are deployed globally, as an example. We even have the FDA deploying people, you know, globally, you know, as an example also. So, yeah, there is harmonization occurring. And I think... FDA leads the way in that, yeah.
But is that harmonization something that's formal or something that's being worked on, you think?
No, I think it's informal. I think, you know, groups like you're involved with the combination products group, it can be very influential when it comes to bringing that up for discussion with a cross-functional group that you're involved with like that. And so we need more of that. So there's really, you know, we used to have the Global Harmonization Task Force. We don't have that anymore. So, you know, we could use something like that, because now, and I think also industry needs to be a part of it. You know, I know we have the IMDRF piece of that organization now that grew into that from the Global Harmonization Task Force, but, you know, they're not really letting industry play a role, you know, kind of in that piece of organization. And we really do need, because we're the ones that have a talk I'm a consultant now, but I mean, you are in the industry, so you know right now you have a unique perspective and insight into benefits and risk and all the challenges that it takes there. So yeah, so we don't have that global organization. You know, we got pieces of global being recognized in different pieces of the, you know, quality organizations around the world, but we really don't have that. And I think we need it. And that's good and neat that you brought that up, because I think you recognize the fractured nature of this, you know.
So one of the chapters in your book that, you know, you highlighted a couple of key concepts, because, you know, basically Kaylin is going on this sort of exploratory exercise and learning things that she doesn't know. One of the big concepts you highlighted is significant change. And so definitely. can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll tell you where that started for me is way back when the MDR, you know, as an example, was in draft form and I was back with a large device company at the time. We got copies of the draft and we started looking at it. And I just remember first time reading about it. All the stuff that Kaylin's dealing with and all the stuff that Ada is saying, wow, that's a loser project. You don't want to get involved with that, you know, thing is very personal to me because it's kind of the way I reacted to it. You know, I've always been sort of wanting to, you know, always, I mean, most of the time, wanting to do cutting edge things that get the attention from senior leaders, you know, things I can get on the platform and talk about all over the world and that kind of stuff. And, you know, significant change was not, you know, a hot topic to address. But yet it's so needed now, and the MDR has brought that to attention because now manufacturers are dealing with changes in their device that then flips it in from, you know, MDD to MDR immediately. And even when you're under MDR, you've got to continue monitoring it. So it needs to be more than just let's do it this weekend and get it over with. It needs to be a lifestyle of a company that needs to address this. So I'll give you a little secret. I'm embarrassed on the one hand to admit this, but there's one chapter in the book, and there's 10 chapters, easy reading, but that I cried as I was writing it, because it was so personal to me. And, you know, Kate, I'm not going to give it away, but Kaylin sort of has a moment in her life too. A lot of that emotions came from me because of rethinking, you know, I'm almost tearing up as I'm talking about it, but rethinking that these devices are actually, you know, they have people's names on them and they're going to be helping people. I mean, think of the work that you're doing as involving the people this device is going to touch. And that's sort of it, you know, for that changes it from like just an activity, you know, like sterilization, we just need to do it, you know, kind of thing, to something. No, sterilization is huge for patients, you know, that kind of thing. And even significant changes are huge in monitoring it along the way, because you want to make changes. Regulatory bodies expect you to make changes, but you've got to have your fingers on the pulse of those changes and does it affect the indication? Does it affect risk profiles and things like that, you know, of the device? So yeah, that was, it was born out of the MDR bringing that to attention. And it was also born from my personal experience with that early on, thinking, yeah, you know, it's a dead end deal. I'm going to find someone else to do this one, you know, kind of thing. But in fact, it's hugely important, hugely important.
I think, you know, I had a guest on the show, John Bingham. This was early on. I think it was maybe episode 5 or 6. Yeah. And I run marathons and do triathlons and things like that. And so this guy had done maybe 50 and wrote a couple books about marathoning, was a columnist for Runner mm-hmm. World. And one of the things he talks about is this idea that when you're on course and you see a bunch of cups on the floor, that those are sort of the leftovers, the trace marks of the people sort of shedding their old selves. And, you know, during that part of your book where you were talking about this device is, it's not just device XYZ, it's, you know, it's Stella Marta and, you know, all the different names, right, that are going to be using it. And so that's sort of where it took me back to that reflection on the tracing to the people that are going to be using it. And just a personal anecdote, maybe I had somebody very close to me just on the combo product space have to administer a self-injection for about a year daily. And they just hated it. The way the IFU was written, the way that the device was set up, it was just basically the opposite of the highlight of their day. The thing they dreaded the most doing, they had to do it every day. So, you know, even though they're still able to administer the dose, I think a lot of times people look at S1 inconvenience as you know, not that big of a deal.
But it is
in aggregate, in aggregate, it does become a big deal.
Yeah, you know, it's so cool you mentioned that, because that putting those names, be a little coy on the one hand, but putting those names in there, actually the names, most of the names are people who have some experience with what I'm trying to talk about. And I kind of want to honor some of my friends and colleagues kind of in that way. And I sort of allude to it in the maybe in the introduction section or something of the book, trying to say, you know, there's a list of 20 names or whatever, but, you know, that's, these are really significant, and they're there by design, you know, as you, to get people to think that, you know, it's not something cold and not living and has no passion. These devices are affecting people with passion and that are living, and that some, in some cases are going to die, you know, if they don't get this, you know, correct. And so, yeah. So yeah, that was the chapter I cried. And I still, even to this day, I kind of tear up as I'm talking about it, because it was just so emotional to me. Yeah,
I do like the chapters that you highlighted, because I think, you know, somebody new to industry, you know, maybe it's maybe intentionally missing design control and a lot of detail, because that's a skill that's really hard. It's hard to conceptualize without actually having kind of something hard to go against. You know, like that's a learned kind of skill, seeing that live. The priceless napkin and post market. Can you talk about that?
Oh man, that was so good. Again, you know, there's lots of people to thank for giving me these experiences to people to reflect on, but we've all been there, right? Where we come in and save the day, and yet it really comes from a point of, you know, really not getting recognized for the effort that you did on a project, you know, kind of thing. That's kind of the root of all this. And you know, our responses are different, you know, kind of thing. Caitlin kind of replies, she just gets pissed and wants to just, she goes to the party, the whatever, you know, but she really just wants to leave the building, get out of the building and, you know, go get lunch somewhere to kind of cool off, because she felt like her name was left off the complimentary email that we all see and get, and, you know, and then it's just wonderful the way life is, right? I mean, after we get through the reaction piece of it, you know, if you have the heart, in which Caitlin does, and this is trying to, you know, model the way for people in the industry, you know, to, you know, make mistakes and learn, but remember to share what you know, and don't, and that's a theme of the book, is to share, you know, your experiences and the goods and bads and make people better. The book can be kind of like a new hire training book in a way, because even though it started with the MDR kind of stuff, it really applies to regulations all over the world in a sense.
I mean, I think, you know, people coming straight out of school are not going to be so specific as to, you know, get into the MDR deep, right? I'd say it's probably unlikely. And I didn't find it to be so, I mean, like the principles are regardless.
Yeah.
MDR versus FDA.
Yes, exactly.
They're all the same.
And I hinted at that in the introduction, I think, to say, you know, this is kind of centric around dealing with the MDR, but the principles apply globally, you know, kind of thing. You're exactly right. But it can be a real neat new hire book, because it's kind of fun to read, you know, in the way. But I give so many tools along the way, too, that you can use tomorrow when you go back to work, you know, that kind of thing. So I did that because I just a root thing of people that we love to be able to do have something that can make our lives a little bit easier tomorrow. You know, we kind of like that, you know, so
I think one note to what you just said is that the text of the book is pretty simple to understand and the concepts are easy.
Yeah.
But when you get into the diagrams and things like that, they're much more heavy and detailed.
Yes.
So you kind of get a little bit of both.
I agree.
Even if you have some experience. So I want to move into audits.
Yeah. The hot seat.
Yeah. The hot seat. Exactly. And, you know, it goes to what we were talking about sharing, but you've worked with a lot of different jurisdictions, right?
Yes. Can you
talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I think they all pretty much have, you know, they are unique in a way, because they focus on different things, you know, and I don't want to call out a geography, you know, but I will say that there are geographies that are very detailed oriented, you know, And if there's different colors, ink or whatever, or whiteout that's used and stuff, they make a big deal about things like that, as an example. And then you do have, you know, geographies that are, I would say, pragmatic and look for the principles, you know, from that perspective, and not so much trying to get their, you know, get their red pen out and catch you, you know, but they're really trying to take that heart of, I know it's here somewhere, help me to find it, you know, kind of thing. And they're kind of like your partner in a way. I use that term lightly, but partner in a way to try to help them to understand also what's going on there. Yeah. So I would say that if I had to pick, I will call this out because it's well known. If I had to pick a regulatory body that is looked at as the best, you know, as an example, it'd be the US FDA, right? I mean, they're the ones that have had, you know, they've had so many firestorms being called before Congress to testify why they did what they did, especially in CDER, that they've been beaten, and therefore they, you know, they have created a remarkable system, you know, as an example. I remember when I had spent time in pharma, and I remember dealing with the regulators there, and then I got into device. And as I'm preparing from the first meeting that I was meeting with the CDRH people, you know, I'm like tense and kind of anxious and concerned. And I just found this whole different personality with CDRH compared to CDER, you know, and I won't say much more about that, but, you know, certainly, I mean, those of you that only deal with CDRH, you think they're awful, I guess, sometimes some of you, but it could be a lot worse. I've been in those lot worse meetings too in the drug piece of the business. But yeah, so, and then you've got emerging markets, you know, that are willing to learn. Come over here and tell us about how you handle recalls, you know, from a manufacturer standpoint. You know, some geographies I've been to where I've done training, even as a consultant, and getting paid by, you know, so the FDA, China, you know, Japan. When I was in the industry, I haven't consulted with the PMD since I've been a consultant, but back when I was in the industry, you know, there are sectors out there that have the heart to want to learn and be the best, right? You know, and it's really fun to be like that. And then you have some that, you know, sort of, or we have a checklist we need to look at and check this off, you know, kind of thing, but without a lot of thinking, you know, that kind of thing. So that's kind of my experience. You know, mostly it's good experience, you know, so.
I do like in the book where Caitlin goes into the audit and she kind of crushes it for the first hour.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then she goes a little wide in terms of her explanation, we'll say.
Yeah.
And then is so taken aback by maybe the mistake that she feels like she's made.
Yeah. Yeah. The blame game, right? The blame game comes in, you know? Yeah. 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 You know, that's, you know, you and I have been there. I mean, our histories, we have similar, you know, historic, you know, experiences with audits and stuff like that. And plus when I was in industry, I would train my staff, people that reported me, I actually had them, you know, get ISO 13485 lead auditor training because I wanted them to think like an auditor, you know, as they're doing whatever they're doing in the company, you know, kind of stuff. But even when we would get prepared for either competent authority audits or a notified body audit and the different types of audits that would come up there in the agency and the FDA too, but we would have training sessions. So, you know, my rule was if you're going to be in the audit room or, you know, and in the front room, you got to meet with me and you got to go through 3 rounds of training, similar to what I did with Caitlin in the book there, you know, yeah. And basically the practicality of it is it only lasts about 15 minutes per training because we started off the same each way, you know, and trying to get them to listen real carefully to the question. And there's a method that I use in the book that I talk about. And I did this for years and years and years. And it was kind of, you know, after the third and fourth time, let's say you do this with the person, you know, they on the one hand, they're saying, oh, why are you asking me that question again? You know, but it's right because you know that you've got the reason here is listen very carefully to the question the auditor or inspector is asking, right? And so this comes from real life experience. And if you have a heart to want to train people to do well, then put them through a training program. It doesn't have to be long. You can give them homework to do and stuff like that. But, you know, even if it's 15 minutes times 4 times, you know, dealing with different aspects of it, let them do that and pass that so that when they get in there, they're, you know, they're really prepared a lot more than they would be had they not met with you. you know, to meet with the auditor. Yeah. And the ability to stay quiet when you need to be quiet and not ramble on, you know, like Kaylin does, you know, and the thing. So.
Yeah, I thought because I remember a situation that I was in where I had just come fresh off of a multi-day audit. And so I was at the doctor's office and they asked me, do you know your social security number or something like, can you tell me your name? And I was just like, yes.
Perfect. That's a great answer, you know? Yeah.
And I do think it's something that comes with experience because if it's something like that, can you tell me your name? There's obviously a judgment call where you say my name is X.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah.
But it brings up the principle that we live by in the quality world, right? So, yeah.
So I want to talk about some of the, you know, you have a couple roles under your belt that are less common, right? IRB member, primary investigator, PRRC. We'll start with PRRC.
Yeah.
You know, what is that role like?
Well, it's a new role to the medical device industry. It's coming out of the MDR, right? We have similar roles in other geographies that we deal with, you know, but the term person responsible for regulatory compliance, both at a company or at an authorized rep, you know, these are now defined in Article 15 of the MDR. And there's sort of like four, and by the way, let me give Team PRRC a shout out, because if you're interested in this, send your application over there and apply. You'll get adjudicated, you'll get looked at, and making sure you have the right qualities and qualifications, you know, and trainings and stuff that you need in order to be recognized as a person responsible for regulatory compliance. It's a great group of people. It's growing. It'll get bigger and bigger as the years go on. And it's a few years old right now, but get in now, because you'll develop really wonderful friendships as your career progresses, you know, as an example. But there's sort of four basic responsibilities of the PRRC. And, you know, one is just, it's all defined in the half page of Article 15 or the two pages. It's defined in half of the page of the couple of pages that are in Article 15. But, you know, one would be making sure that you have an established QMS system and that you're checking your products against and through the QMS system, so that you're going through the correct conformity assessments, you know, as an example, and it's all documented in your quality system. The other piece would be making sure that your documentation in the quality system is created and maintained, right? And you know, you're all over this because you know how this is a living system, and looking at quality systems as a living system. And chaining, you know, updating documents when new data becomes available, and even if your conclusions are going to be the same, you know, making sure you document that you've looked at this again and things are the same, you know, as an example. The other piece is the big PMS piece, and making sure that you're following the correct expectations for a post-market surveillance perspective, and then also from a reporting and vigilance perspective, you know, as an example, that you're following the right reporting into the geographies correctly. And the final thing is, if you're doing investigational products, the expectation is that the PRRC needs to ensure that the correct GSPRs are being applied for your investigational product, and that you attest and you try to ensure that everything is being done to protect the health and the safety of the subject. So you want to ensure that, you know, that you're following the GSPRs, but you need to step back. Have we done everything with this investigational device that to ensure that we're doing what we can to make it, you know, safe and protecting the health, you know, of the patient? So those are kind of the general things. There's a lot more to discuss about this, but that's kind of a role. It's kind of a neat role, right? If you have a heart, you know, some of the quality systems have statements, like your quality manual have a statement, you know, build it as if it's intended to be used by a member of the family, or something like that, so that people can readily think about, you know, one sentence, you know, quality statement, you know, build it as if it's intended for a member of my family. It's kind of easy to understand. So if you get asked by an auditor or inspector and they say, tell me a little bit about the quality system, can you describe it to me? You can rattle that off in one sentence, you know, as an example. And if you really truly believe it, and it's part of your, you know, living nature of the of your life in the quality system, then, you know, that's it's easy to talk about. Yeah.
I think one of the maybe areas of confusion that I have is how, from my estimation, it seems like a PRRC can be external to a company.
Well, in Europe, yeah, they've got some guidelines around the size of the company and the amount of money that you make. So the big companies will need to have a employee in-house. Or more employees to make a team of PRRCs. If you have less than 50 people and less than 10 million euros on your annual budget page, then you can qualify to have a consultant PRRC. And that's where I try to, you know, have I gone in and talked to companies about, and I've served on, you know, when I was with a major company as a PRRC team member, you know, as an example, but where I function is in that less than 50 people, less than 10 million euros kind of thing. So there are some financial things, and it's an abstract. If you look at Article 15, look at the bottom of the page, and there's an abstract down there that talks about that.
Got it. Well, as we move to close, I want to ask you a couple of kind of personal questions. What is a book that changed your life besides Mythical?
Well, it's interesting you asked me that because you know I you gave me a heads up that you were going to ask that. So let your listeners know. And I thought about that, and you know, on the one hand, I was quick to like identify one book, but then I thought to myself, there's actually several books. So just real quickly, I would say when I moved to the Bay Area about 16 years ago or whatever, yeah, from Chicago, and then I've been all over the place, but recently from Chicago down here in Silicon Valley. And so I wanted to be part of the community, and I got this book, the Steve Jobs book by Walter Isaacson. This kind of, I don't know if you can see that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I actually read it. I read it, and because I wanted to, because back then, I mean, this was, he was still alive at the time, and so influential. It's still influential today. It was a book that would help me understand the Silicon Valley kind of thing. So I always tell people I fell in love with Steve Jobs as I was reading the book, and then I fell out of love with him as I was learning about him personally. You know, and I had to push myself. I'm telling you, I had to really, and this was like, I don't know, about an eighth of the way in, you know, you start finding out about some bad things about Steve, and I really had to push through, and I fell back in love with Steve as he goes forward, you know, kind of thing. So that was a very influential, changing my life kind of book, especially here in the Silicon Valley. The other book that was really instrumental was Five Dysfunctions of a Team.
I love that book.
I was always leading teams, and you know, I've done this with several teams that I've been in charge of, you know, applying these principles and stuff like that. The author here lives in San Francisco, by the way. So, and then there was this book called Simple, because, you know, those of us that have been in the industry, especially updating SOPs, we keep making them more and more complicated, right, in our procedures and stuff like that. And this was a book, I had a book club that I ran when I was in a large, made up of cross-functional people. And we did this book one time, and it was really meaningful to me because it can be simple. I mean, you know, we got to have, we're regulated industry. So you got to have, you know, things you got to do there, but you can look for ways to make it simple. I remember that Word program has a grammar function where you can look at the grammar level, the reading level of things. I used to like put our procedures through that and let it grade. And it was like,
yeah, Shakespearean English.
Yeah. You know, it was like, you had to have like, you know, a postdoc level of experience to really understand this. And so I sort of use that as like, well, see, we're here to revise this today, but, you know, we really want to make it kind of simple. But these people who are doing the procedure, they're not postdocs, you know, they don't have all these different degrees. You know, some of these are graduating from high school, some of them dropped out of college, and some of them graduated from college. So keep that in mind as we do this. And so this book called Simple, Conquering the Crisis of Complexity was a wonderful book. And recently the book that I got through reading was this thing called
Ryan Holiday.
The Obstacle is the Way. Have you seen this, by the way?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So it's about, you know, what stands in the way becomes the way. And it's really about, you know, you're frustrated and things about what's in front of you. Look at that as, oh, you know, I'm going to learn something here to do that. So that's that book. And I've got two books that I'm going to be reading. I just got from Amazon. One is called 28 Days to Save the World. So this was recommended to me by a friend. And then The other one, this is really kind of funny. It says, thank you for arguing. So I'm really intrigued by these two books. And so those are my next two that I'll be reading to kind of get things going. So yeah.
That's awesome. Patrick Lin, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, the way that you wrote your book kind of reminds me of that, you know, storytelling to make a more nuanced point maybe. And I love Ryan Holiday.
I follow him quite
closely.
Yeah.
Daily Stoic. What one last question? What is something you're excited about?
What is something I'm excited about? So I'll tell you. Basically, I'm writing the second book of Mythical Medical, and I'm not making a lot of money on this, right? It's free if you have a Kindle account. It's 99 cents, and if you get the paperback, it's $14.95 or something like that. For the book that I resell, I think I get like $1.50 or something like that that gets deposited, and they pay me. They go through how many did you sell this month, and then they wait a month and pay me after that, right? So I get these strings of $1.59 deposits, here and there and here and there, and so it's definitely not about the money, but it's really about the experience, like our careers in a way. So I'm creating another company called this By Design Venture Capital Firm, and this Mythical Medical and By Design are going to combine together to make innovative devices all over the world and stuff like that. I've got all kinds of cool, some more characters. I got all the characters in the first book are continuing on, and I'm going to be part of that. So if you had to say I'm excited about it, I like to make money. I'm excited about making money. But if you ask that question, I'm really excited about writing that. I didn't get to do creative writing when I was in academia and when I was in big pharma or big devices, because we were all told, be careful about what you put in the public domain, kind of thing. But now I get to be creative, and I don't have those constraints anymore. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you for coming on, David. It's a pleasure having you.
Yeah, thank you for the invite. It's been a lot of fun.